For the longest time, the word literacy referred simply to being able to read and write. And as with many words, it's evolved to be an add-on to things like digital literacy, that is, skills used in performing tasks on digital platforms and in digital environments, or, say, political literacy, the ability to understand or participate in political activities. And then that brings us to media literacy, the ability to think critically about different types of media and the information conveyed within these avenues. To define it immediately points out its inherently tough to navigate terrain. It's both the act of thinking critically about each type and act of media, as well as thinking critically about what is being said through them and why and how. To be sure, that is no small task. It means almost simultaneously and constantly considering all the platforms on which we receive information. Blogs, social media platforms, magazines, books, video games, music, websites, print ads, billboards, radio, podcasts, online ads, and then fold in news organizations and their print, mobile, desktop, and social media paths to sharing content, and put all of that into context, and it is a lot. Given the crowding, it's more important than ever, then, to practice and continue to hone our media literacy skills so that we can apply them roundly to the many platforms on which we do receive information. Our ability to access, find, analyze, consider, contemplate, evaluate, and sometimes even create different types of media, both in platform and content, is an essential skill of the modern world. The trouble is, the messages are getting more and more complex and thus harder and harder to decipher. Then take into account how history, access, and power structures factor into media literacy and add in the complications of our quote-unquote fake news era, in which some deliberately skew content to suit an agenda, in which ad companies spend millions to better understand how to play on our emotions and aspirations with colors, images, and words, and a whole slew of other things. And there's a lot to dig into here. But nonetheless, that is our aim tonight, to examine many of the issues contained within this notion of media literacy. We'll take a look at ways to step up our own critical thinking skills, to understand how messages shape our culture and our society, to more consciously recognize what some storytellers want us to do or to believe, as well as become more aware of things like bias, spin, and persuasion. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN. We're playing with that show opener, and you know I love the Smiths. So we had to throw that song in. It's all good. I love that song. It's fun. So we're talking about media literacy tonight, and we're exploring this notion of what it is, and it's really the ability to analyze the merits and faults in each of the different types of media and within the information conveyed via all these avenues. Why does that matter? Why even take that topic on at all? Well, look, simply put, there's a lot of information that comes at us in a given day. And when the stakes are as high as they have been recently, with, say, contentious elections, international relations influenced by, you know, a tweet, outright accusations of fake news, our self-esteem under siege by the cosmetics and garment industries, old school gender roles reinforced again and again by even simple stuff like ads for laundry and peanut butter. Well, we need to get it together. I think we can all agree on that. So to help us do that and participate in tonight's discussion, we will be joined by Amanda Warner, creator of the fake news simulation game, Fake It to Make It, Ashley Humphreys, professor at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism, Erica Hobbs, the Chicago program manager of the News Literacy Project, and Michelle Lipkin, executive director of the National Association for Media Literacy Education. That's a lot of stuff, but I've got some smart people to talk about it, and we will be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Good to be back with you. We missed a couple of weeks together because of some particular broadcast of a couple of sports teams. We wish them well. We love them, and we love when they're on the station. But you know what? I am darn happy to be back after being preempted for a little bit. So tonight's topic is media literacy, and that has a lot of stuff attached to it. I feel like we might be handling a powder keg here, but there is a lot of stuff. There are advertising considerations and marketing, and there are, you know, certainly news and fake news pieces of this, and there are just lots of stuff that we need to think about when we think about all the ways we receive information in the world right now. But one that's really, really topical, one that's up in a big way, say for the last couple of months, has been this idea of fake news. We shall not turn this into a political show. That is my other show that I do, Guth and Hupke on Politics. But fake news has been a thing that's up, right? I don't think a day goes by without us talking about fake news on some level. And so when we think about it, it's hard to define. It's hard to say exactly what it is, but you know it when you see it. So someone, a very smart person that we have on the phone right now, Amanda Warner, created a fascinating tool to help teach us about fake news. And it is a game called Fake It to Make It. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for joining us tonight.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for being with us. Well, I think this is so fascinating because as we talk about fake news, you know, those of us here that have worked in newsrooms and that continue to do so, it's, you know, we can spot those elements pretty easily. A lot of people can spot elements of fake news pretty easily. But I think we have oversimplified it a bit. And there's really a lot that goes into and a lot of motivations for fake news. And these are all addressed in your game, which I think is so fascinating and eye-opening and a little bit heart-stopping to play. So tell us, if you would, about the game and how you came to create it.
Sure. So in this game, you really step into the role of someone who is creating and distributing fake news for profit. So you were talking sort of about the different types of fake news, and this does really focus on profit-focused fake news. So you start out, you pick a modest financial goal, like buy music equipment, and really walk through the process of starting a site, learning about ad revenue, copying articles from other fake news sites, eventually writing your own articles. And you have to spread all these articles sort of through social media by creating or buying on social media profiles. So some people have talked about it sort of as being like a simulation, and in some ways it is, of how this works, just to really hopefully give people a better understanding. So as you say, they're more likely to recognize some of the common elements or common motivations for doing this.
And was there one particular thing that served as the catalyst for you to create this, or was it just a buildup, like many of us are in, a buildup of stuff that you just said, enough, I have to do my part to help fix this?
Yeah, I think it's sort of the latter, like you were talking about. I think that it was a buildup. It was the frustration with the amount of fake news that was in the world. I feel like the thing that sort of triggered my imagination and really inspired the game was a series of articles about the Macedonian teenagers who created a lot of the fake news leading up to the U.S. election. And they weren't the only ones creating fake news. There were definitely people in the United States and elsewhere in the world who were doing this as well. But it fascinated me because in most cases, they didn't really care about the outcome of the election. They weren't trying to change anyone's mind. They just saw a business opportunity and they took it. So, I mean, it wasn't anything sinister. They probably don't think of themselves as villains. It's just a business opportunity. And I think understanding that can happen and being able to put yourself in those shoes can help you be more skeptical when you're on the reading end of things like this.
Certainly. And so what are the main skills that you hope that people will, or maybe main aha moments that you'll hope people take away after playing this game, Fake It to Make It?
Sure. So, I mean, a big one is just how cheap and easy it really is to set up a site that looks relatively credible. So I think increasing skepticism about that. And then also just understanding how people will play on emotions to spread articles. So I think a lot of the articles that have spread very widely do so because they make people angry or they make people afraid. And so I would really like people, if they're looking at something and they're like, oh, this just infuriates me so much. I always knew it was like this, blah, 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 blah. Just think to themselves that, oh, maybe someone is trying to make me angry or afraid so that I will spread this article or whatever, but just having that skepticism about having their emotions manipulated.
Right. So when you're playing this game, there's a lot of different approaches and I don't want to say opportunities, but options anyway, to the, all these methods to promote content, to build it, to expand it. Take us through what some of those are that are actually really happening in many cases of just, you know, fraudulent news stories.
Sure. So one of the things that is commonly done is starting out with something that is true or close to true, and then twisting it. So say you might start out with a scientific study that was published somewhere, and maybe it's kind of boring, but there's an element of it, let's say it's about health, that you could twist to make people feel like, oh, my health is in imminent danger, and you'll probably have to make up some statistics and sort of like twist things around a bit. But you can turn this thing that was partially true into something that's really scary. And when you do that, if someone like just does a quick Google of it, they might see this study and be like, oh, look, it's true. So I think that's a way to make something more convincing, is starting out with something that either is true or maybe is commonly believed to be true and playing on that.
Fascinating. That's and terrifying, right? I mean,
I know.
I have, as I was looking through it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is really, I mean, this is happening. We know it is, but to see how it's done was a little bit heart stopping. And, you know, it one thing I have long worried about with fake news and its spread anyway, because I think just the techniques of spreading something is very interesting because it's so emotionally driven. I have long bemoaned email forwards. Like if you get an email forward trying to influence your vote or your dollars or whatever, and it's in Comic Sans and it's sent to 300 people, you know, maybe check in about that. But nonetheless, I think we get them all the time. And they're so interesting how willing we are. I'm saying royal we, I'm not saying I do this per se or you, but you know, how willing we are as humans to believe something because we got that email from, you know, our college buddy or our dad or our, you know, our neighbor or whatever. And that person to person aspect of it backfires so terribly when it comes to fact checking, because even then, if you go back and say, yeah, that's not really how it happened, or if you send a Snopes link or something, somehow you've just made Thanksgiving awkward.
Totally. I think that social connection that you bring up is really important with that. And people are more likely to trust things. And yes, as you say, things can get awkward because of all of this. I think I read also somewhere that even if you read something and if even in the same time you're reading it, you read that it's not true, you're more likely to remember it later as being true. And I think that's just one of the ways our minds confuse us, even when things are in Comic Sans.
Right. Comic Sans or no, right? Confirmation bias is alive and well and quite real. So as you were building this game and adding all of these elements that teach people how to make fake news and how it is so quickly spread, what was that fact-finding process like for you as you were gathering up all these, and how long of a process was that? I have to think it was kind of short because you referenced these, the Macedonian teenagers as kind of being one of the last straws for you to go and do something.
Yeah, and so it was about a five-month process from starting until our official launch. And so I started out reading about the Macedonian teenagers as well as other people who were creating fake news and that process. And there's a lot of really useful information about that online, both from the standpoint of what people are actually doing, but there's also a lot of information about how, like, hey, if you want to make money and get things to spread, here's how to do this. It's not really necessarily about fake news, but it's definitely about the same concepts people use to spread fake news. So that's very available online. And then I also spend a lot of time on sites that are fake news sites and looking at headlines, looking at the breakdown of like what techniques they were using. I would go to Snopes and PolitiFact and sites like that, look at articles they debunked. And when they talked about like, oh, this had this element of truth, or oh, this changed the statistic, I would sort of look at that and try to, I guess, deconstruct how these articles had been put together so that I could put together the same mechanisms in the game.
So after people have played this game and become familiar, what are the, you know, questions that you want on people's minds before they're sharing content next time? How do you hope that change, or how do you hope that playing the game will change them?
I mean, so fundamentally, if if anything, the biggest thing, if it could change, would be people not getting their news from social media. And I don't know that that is going to change, but I feel like that in itself just creates lots of problems. Whereas if you go to like a trusted news sites and look at news, it's just a very different world than if you're scrolling through your Facebook feed. I don't know that that's going to happen, though. So that's my biggest wish. But I feel like if you're looking at something on social media, just having just this skepticism and this idea that things might be presented in a misleading way, even if there's an element of truth, I guess I just want people to have that in the back of their minds. So if they're but see something that's even a little bit questionable before they hit share, they go to Snopes, they go to PolitiFact, they Google things, do their own research. I don't think they're going to be able to recognize every fake news article as fake just by looking at it. But if they have that suspicion, maybe they'll go do the research afterwards.
Here's hoping. I think the social media part of that you bring up is really, really an interesting thing. I've gotten in the habit of making a note on tweets and on Facebook shares. I'll say on Facebook, I'll often say, guys, read this. Don't just internet read it. Meaning don't just look at the headline and not click through, or don't just read the lead and assume you've read the whole thing. Or I'll make a note. I think just yesterday I tweeted something that said, read to the end for nuances, because it was so important. And I think that drives me crazy, but I do feel an obligation to do that often, to say it's important that you read this whole thing, which I even feel like 5 years ago was not a thing we were saying to each other at all.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think people skim now. They read headlines, maybe just share based on the headline or just read bits of it. I think that's a great idea, what you're doing.
Well, let's see. I think it's annoying the bejesus out of all of my social networks. So we'll see if it catches on at all. Well, so where can people go to find out more about Fake It to Make It, participate in the game, learn and be better, more savvy consumers of media?
Well, the game is publicly available. It's on fakeittomakeitgame.com. So they can go there and learn a lot more. There's both the game itself, and then there's an about page that has some additional resources for fact checking.
Excellent. FakeItToMakeItGame.com. I will be sure and share that link on the WGN Radio page once an archive of this show is posted to the podcast page. Amanda Warner, thank you so much for being with us tonight and for the very cool tool that you have built. We will be sure and check in with you again as more fake news stuff arises.
That's great. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much. Have a great night. All right. We're going to take a little break and then we're going to get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to talk about the advertising part of this, the marketing strategies, consumer behavior, and how data drives so much. Back in just a bit on 720. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Tonight, we are talking about media literacy. That is a big topic with lots of stuff wrapped around it, right? There's a lot of aspects to that. We were just talking with Amanda Warner, who created the Fake It to Make It game, where you get to experience what it is like to make fake news and get it to spread virally by appealing to emotions. And fake news has been a big part of the conversation lately when we think about media literacy. But one area that we've talked about on this program before, and one that really keeps me up at night sometimes, is where all of media literacy, where that fits in when we talk about advertisements, where we talk about marketing strategies and how those might be, you know, manipulating us and playing with our minds and playing on our very nature, but also using data, all the data that's out there about us, using that to influence what we buy, how we spend our dollars, all of those things. So, to have that conversation with us, we have brought in an expert, and that is Dr. Ashley Humphreys. She is an associate professor at Medill. She's trained as a sociologist, and she looks at these very topics around consumer behavior and marketing strategy. Ashley, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing part of your Saturday with us. Well, so I want to start by at the kind of the very first step of this staircase, and that is, as it pertains to consumer behavior and marketing strategies and advertising, how do you define, in your work in particular, how do you define media literacy?
Right. It's a good question because, as you said, media literacy is a sort of a complex concept or construct.
Yeah.
You know, we really bring it back to, and here I'm thinking sort of digital literacy. It kind of has five components. So from a consumer behavior perspective, it's not, of course, what we think of as just literacy, being able to literally understand the characters in front of you, but it also has to do with computer literacy. So how do you use a computer? How do you navigate the internet? How do you use the back button or your privacy settings or things like that? But also communication literacy. So how do you actually interpret? Let's say you go online and you're reading reviews. How do you actually interpret the kinds of language and acronyms and other kinds of codes there? And of course, it can also include information literacy. So how do you assess the source of the information? Is it trustworthy? And how does that kind of intersect with what you're being told?
There's a lot to it, right? So
yeah.
So then with all of that said, and as those that very complex table laid there, how, in your mind, what are the first initial steps of developing critical thinking as it pertains to our behavior as consumers?
Right. You know, I think broadly speaking, it goes back to understanding really the context of the information you're being given. Not only understanding who's giving it to you, where you're getting the information from. Let's say, for example, you go on to look up a health question or a medication question as a consumer. You know, is Yahoo Answers the best place to get your health information? Maybe not, right? Others argue that even WebMD is quite limited, right? So it's sort of having an awareness of the context, and that it can have to do with the source, but it can also have to do with certain filtering or selection mechanisms. You know, for example, if you're logged into your Gmail or to some kind of Google account, what you see will be filtered for you. It could be according to your location, but it could be according to a number of other things. And so just having kind of a general awareness of what information is coming to you and kind of how it got there is really sort of the first step.
Certainly. And you know, you mentioned critical thinking skills and learning them and nurturing them. And I feel like that's such a through line of tonight's show, really, is developing those critical thinking skills. And that's such a tricky thing because it makes you have to say, what do I don't know that I don't know, which I think is a hard place mm-hmm. just for human beings to be in. I think it's our nature to want to believe we know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people get into habits, right? Especially as we get older, we get into habits of sort of go-to sources and things without thinking about sort of the broader context that we're operating in.
Yeah. So what are you, when you think of kind of the biggest enemies of this right now, you know, cultural, is it a habit? Is it a product? Is it a something else? What are kind of the biggest things that keep you up at night when related to this topic?
You know, I mean, top of mind for me, of course, is privacy, just because of the recent legislation or rollback of legislation regarding internet service providers' ability to share private browsing information, right, to sell that information. There are things that are kind of happening both legally but also technologically that I think people just don't even think about. It would never occur to people to kind of to think that this kind of stuff might be shared and used, you know, both for mostly commercial purposes. But, you know, I think we are seeing right now the negotiation of how people control their information, the information that they produce, you know, and many people just kind of aren't aware of some of the dynamics underlying that.
Right. You know, earlier today on the Business Lunch Show, I was talking with Connor Doherty from the New York Times, who had just written on this very topic about the rolling back of some of the internet privacy laws. And it's such a complex thing. I'm glad you brought that one up in particular, because I think that word just sort of strikes fear in us when you say privacy. Oh, of course I want privacy. What do you mean? What, you know, but some of it is rather innocuous information, our name, the state we live in. That's probably, you know, fairly easy to find anyway, and probably okay. That's something most of us would probably admit freely in a public forum. But then I think it really just becomes a matter of us not knowing what is being collected and what purpose it's serving. So how deep are we in, really, you know, as we as we are thinking about all the data and just beginning to really start to wrestle with these privacy issues, just kind of right behind European markets have done this. Mm-hmm. You know, how deep are we in, and is it going to be a matter of backtracking or changing behavior, or you know, I think there's a lot there, right?
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I think merits bearing in mind is it is sort of a double-edged sword. It's a great convenience to have my name and address and even my credit card number filled in when I go to buy something online, you know? And so there are contexts when I actually kind of want that, and I give that information more or less freely. But then I think where we really run into problems is when we sort of lose control of those gates and that access, right? Where information is used for purposes that we didn't intend.
Right, right. And it's that thing, right, where it's, if you don't know what the product is, then the product is you. And I think that's very, very applicable here, because there is a cost for that kind of convenience that I think we all benefit from. And yet we, on some level, you know, Grubhub knows what we order every week, and, you know, all of the services that we use. And, you know, I think where people, I have seen people that even don't think much about this topic, I feel like I often see a little bit of blowback about retargeting ads. You know, you'll search something and then later you'll see it in a browser. I often see people go, what does this mean? Why is this happening? You know, I'll see some users even screen grab that and post it. I've seen people post that to Facebook and say, oh my gosh, I bought this bag 3 days ago and now it's being advertised to me. Big brother. Yes, and it is kind of a thing to unravel and unpack, but I think it's a matter of understanding the tools and processes for sure. But then, as you brought up earlier, I think it's a matter too of backing up and reteaching or teaching critical thinking skills we may have passed over or let slide earlier.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, another thing to think about too, you mentioned the context. The comparison between Europe and the U.S. And, you know, we do this survey where we measure people's feelings about privacy every quarter, every financial quarter, and we compare them with Europe. And in Europe, privacy scores are always much, much higher, of course, because as just an average consumer, you can have a little more faith that, well, if I put my credit card information in here, there are some safeguards sort of down the line. Whereas in the U.S., we see privacy scores that are generally much lower. And you know, that means something from a consumer perspective, but that also means something from a marketing or company perspective. You know, I mean, companies, I think, generally speaking, want customers to feel good, safe about the information that they provide.
Certainly. We're talking with Ashley Humphreys, who is an associate professor at Medill at Northwestern, all about this topic of media literacy, particularly as it's pertaining to consumer behavior and marketing and advertising and all of those topics where we get really, really nervous about our data being out in the world. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN hits. Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one topic and talk about it the entire night. And tonight's topic is media literacy. And holy moly, is there so much to that? Even just doing the pre-show prep work, I was like, I might be stepping into way more than I can do in 2 hours. And that will definitely be the case. But I have assembled some very, very smart people that know what the heck they're talking about tonight to help us get through these topics. And right now, right before the break, we've been talking with Dr. Ashley Humphreys, who is an associate professor at Medill at Northwestern, and she has been helping us think through all of the issues connected to consumer behavior, marketing, advertising, data, privacy, all of those big issues that we think about when we think about this topic of media literacy. It is but one topic connected to that bigger topic, but nonetheless, it's a really, really important one, and one that certainly is worth our time and consideration. So we were talking talking a lot about thinking critically before the break, and we were a lot about our habits and data and all that, and I want to bridge that a little bit. When we think about data, the first time we really saw it in a big mainstream way in politics was the initial Obama campaign. We saw data used in a really, really fascinating way in that campaign. And then fast forward to this past election, and we see this topic of media literacy and data in a very, very different way. And there's a lot there. And I, as I said at the top of the show, although there will be some political parts of the show, it's not the politics show. It's the media literacy show. But nonetheless, when we think about this, what role did these newer pieces play out the largest in your mind? We all know there were accusations of fake news. There were data breach issues. There were lots of things going on. But what do you think the key ones were from your professional point of view, Ashley?
Right. You know, and just thinking about the comparison between really when social media first made its electoral debut with the Obama campaign and then Trump, you know, I was writing this book about social media, and I used the Obama campaign as an example where social media really let the campaign reach voters on a very kind of narrow personal level, and used it as kind of a case study. And sort of a hopeful case study about mobilizing participation. And I have to say now, teaching, of course, from the book, we sort of have a completely new and interesting and different lens on it after the Trump campaign, because, of course, you know, in a similar way, you did see the candidate speaking directly to the voters and mobilizing voters in particular ways, only with the companion of fake news and some of these other issues in a kind of a different, with a very different tone and with different implications, according to some scholars. So I think the comparison is really interesting. We definitely have a different point of view on the role of social media in elections now.
Certainly do. And I think, you know, there's still a lot of conversation happening around the role that Facebook itself played and what it showed us in our timelines and how that was able to, you know, potentially sway people one way or the other. I know I post about politics a lot because I also do a political show. And as much as I'm posting about politics, I still felt I could feel that algorithm moving during the election for sure. I could absolutely feel that of just what I was being shown and what was there. So I think that is a big topic, but it also to me kind of points at another piece of this, and that really has a lot to do with access and almost about it almost becomes a conversation about class really and all these other social justice topics really quickly when we start thinking about who stories reach and how and why. And I wonder if you have a comment on that, particularly in the area about access.
Yeah, so I think there are sort of two pieces to this. The first piece is just the idea of narrowcasting, you know, that the internet and social media in particular allows you to target very specific messages at a particular populace. And because of the filter bubble and other things that we sort of know about as scholars, there are voters or consumers who kind of live in a particular media bubble, both on the left and on the right. So narrowcasting is kind of one dynamic that's really emerged in the last decade or so. And then I would also say there's even a broader issue that you mentioned of access, right? So about 87% of the U.S. population has internet access in their home. And that means that 13% don't have regular internet access in their home. And those two people tend to be older. They tend to live in more rural areas. And they tend to only have really a high school education or lower. And, of course, correspondingly, we find that digital literacy, of course, varies by income and education, as you might think. So even amongst age groups, so we tend to think, well, oh, younger consumers, of course, they're digitally literate. That's really not actually true. When you start to break down those younger demographics, education has a huge role to play in digital literacy.
So what components do you think are perhaps missing, or maybe let's back that up. I was going to say what components are missing from earlier educational moments, but maybe the question is, when do we need to start talking about critical thinking and media literacy in school curriculum now?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's been tricky to navigate, I think, because, you know, people first thought, oh, well, access is really all people need, right? Give them iPads or give them computer labs and the digital divide or, you know, digital inequality will be erased. And we see that's really, really not the case. And in fact, there's even some indications that offering that much technology without the corresponding education can kind of lead students astray, you know, because you really have to teach people what the devices are for, and not just down a narrow path of usage, but you really have to give people an idea of the spectrum of uses for these devices really early on.
There's so much to this. It's so complex, but thank you so much for being with us tonight and helping us start to unpack some of it. There is a lot here. But everybody, go find her book. It is called Social Media Enduring Principles. Lots of information in there. Ashley Humphreys, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We will invite you back on, I'm sure, because this is a topic that I think we'll keep on giving for quite a while.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening. All right. We're going to take a little break and then get you to news. And when we come back, we're going to take what we were just talking about and run with it a little bit and talk about kids and education and how media literacy factors into that and what parents and teachers can be doing when we think about this big topic to help kids have an easier time of it. So all that and more when we come back on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we pick one big old topic and we spend the whole show taking it apart and considering it and wrestling with it. Sometimes we come to a resolution. Sometimes we leave with more questions. And this might be one of those shows because as we are tackling this big topic of media literacy, there is a lot to it, way more than I think we think about when we think about this topic of critical thinking when we're looking at ads, at news stories, at all of the things that all of the places where we're getting information in our day-to-day lives. So we are going to keep the parade of very smart people coming. And now we have a very special guest in studio, the Chicago Program Manager for the News Literacy Project, Erica Hobbs. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So tell us a bit about the News Literacy Project and the goals of the organization.
Sure. We are a nonpartisan nonprofit, and we are headquartered in Bethesda, but we reach students from all over the country and also in a few dozen countries overseas. So what we do is that we teach students how to tell fact from fiction from whatever they're reading or seeing or hearing.
No small task.
None.
There's a lot to that. Mm-hmm. And so how do you or at what level do you start that conversation with a kid? Because I think, oh, maybe high schoolers could take that. But then I'm like, well, but middle schoolers, but then elementary. It seems like maybe there are waves of introducing this topic.
I think you're right. So we're about 9 years old and we started originally developing curriculum for students who are in grades 7 through 12. And the reason why we did that is because we use journalism as the yardstick for quality news, for quality journalism. And we found that students needed to have a little bit of exposure to the First Amendment mm-hmm. in order to grasp the concepts of news literacy. We're finding now, though, that the demand is much greater and that teachers in grades as young as fifth grade are using our materials and asking for our materials. Right now they're scaffolding down and pretty soon we'll be able to meet that demand too with other lessons.
That's so interesting. I mean, do you attribute that to kids getting more sophisticated or just that we have greater access to information than ever or something else? Or maybe all of those things.
It's
all
probably
of the above.
A little bit of all of those, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. It is a very fascinating topic. And I think it's very interesting, in particular, as we relate it to kids. So from your organization standpoint, how do you define the act of being media literate?
Well, for us, it's news literacy, which is a little bit different. So we sort of fall underneath the umbrella of media literacy. And the way that we define news literacy is that it's the ability to evaluate the credibility of the news and information that you're consuming.
Again, no small task. That I feel like there's some adults that can't do that, as we have seen in the world. There's adults that can't do that. So what are some of the first skills that you start working with? Because you mentioned introducing them to the First Amendment. What are some of those first ahas that you hope that the kids have when you work with them?
Well, one of the things that we found throughout the years was that students really didn't understand the types of information that were out there, that were available to them. So we do teach very basic things, including, raw information, propaganda, news, publicity, those kinds of things. And then our curriculum takes them through a spectrum of ideas and concepts so that they do become news literate. So we talk about the First Amendment, the importance of that. We talk about the importance of a watchdog role in a democracy. We also talk about news judgment and news standards. What does quality mean? And then we also, some of our newest materials also take students into brand new fields or brand new ideas. So algorithms and the role of algorithms and what that means for them with what they're seeing or they're reading, mostly what they're reading online, and also branded content. Because sometimes, some things are, there's so much information and it's so confusing, right? You have to be able to kind of sift that out.
That's an interesting one. And that's I'm surprised it's taken an hour into the show for that topic to come up, because it used to be very clear when we were reading a magazine and suddenly it was a very different font, sometimes different paper, and at the top, advertisement. It was very clear when we were reading this, weird narrative that was we didn't call it branded or branded content then, but that's what it was. And now, although there are a lot of legal issues around it and regulations, they're not always there. It's still, I think, new enough that it's kind of on some level the Wild West, and we see brands maybe not doing it to the letter of the law sometimes. And I cannot tell you how often I see somebody tweet something like that as fact, and it just stops my heart when I see that happening.
Us too.
Right. Right. We're in solidarity on that hard stopping there. I mean, it is really interesting. So what is your opinion on that? Do you think that as regulations catch up to consumer behavior and the way we behave online and interact with news, that our savvy around the topic will catch up and increase? Or do you think there's another component that we haven't gotten to yet?
Well, I'm sure there are several factors at play. So, I mean, as you know, advertisers are scrambling for space. They're trying to figure out how to get our attention, readers' attentions, because there's so many things, right, that are vying for that attention. So they're trying to look like things that work, right? They're trying to get the clicks. They're trying to get the eyeballs. And so they're experimenting, right? And so in our point of view, it's our job to teach students and adults how to tell the difference, right? And how to be skeptical of what they're looking at, how to notice the difference, how to be skeptical, and then what to do. So, but the most important thing for us is, it's discernment, right? But it's also the steps after that, because we want consumers and students and citizens to understand that they're in control, and we want to teach them what the right actions might be to take.
I think that's another issue. This came up with our last guest. Sometimes teaching skepticism is one of those asking people to know the things they don't know. And that's so tricky because you really have to have a big aha moment to flip that script in your brain. I think that's probably more applicable to adults than kids. I would guess that kids are probably pretty open to a concept, or more so than adults anyway. I've long thought that it's adults that need the most TLC with topics like that. Where do you find pushback from kids or an unwillingness to believe or buy in early on in the process of educating them?
Well, what we know is that it's hard for them too. So, we've already talked about this. Sophisticated audience have a hard time telling what's fact and fiction. I mean, sometimes even I fall for things. I tend to fall for celebrity deaths, right? And you have to pause and say, wait a minute, do I really want to click or share? But there are studies out, including a Stanford study that came out in November, that shows that even digital natives are having a hard time making sense of what it is that they're reading. They think, for example, that news comes from Facebook. And they have to learn, they have to dig a little bit deeper to understand what the role of Facebook actually is and then where their information is coming from.
I think that is a really interesting topic. And every time I've spoken, I speak to a lot of different groups, but every time I've spoken to groups of young people, I always ask them about their media consumption habits, mostly because I want to know what my future bosses do. That's A. Mm-hmm. But also, I think it behooves us to learn. You can't force a behavior to change in that way. Once the genie's out of the bottle and a habit is established, I think it's incumbent upon an industry to adapt rather than keep going the same way and just hope eventually people start buying newspapers again or listen to terrestrial radio versus online or whatever. And so I think it's important to take all of those into consideration. But I had one conversation that really stuck with me. I asked a group of high schoolers, I showed them, a news site on a tablet and a phone, on an app rather, the newspaper, physical paper, and I started asking them about. Oh, and I showed them their YouTube channel, and I said, well, you know, which of these appeal to you the most and why? And they didn't have much to say at first, but I finally kind of kept asking questions, and the newspaper was a really fascinating item because one of the boys finally said, you know, I think, and he points to the front page, he said, I find that to be quite arrogant. And I said, arrogant? Why is it arrogant? He said, because that story with that very big picture is something on the other side of the world from a place I will never be able to afford to go. But this story down here with a small piece, that's my brother's high school, or that's the high school my brother went to. And I know that kid that got shot, and that's personal. So we had this conversation about news judgment and why things are covered and I asked them, okay, so what sources get that right? Where do you go that does that? And they all said, Google. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, how do you know what to click on once you get to Google? And they're like, whatever's at the top, whatever the headline looks right. And that was really a powerful moment to me. That was probably about, I don't know, 6 years ago now when this conversation first started entering newsrooms about how to deal with digital disruption. But I think about that kid all the time because to me that was such a tell about media consumption habits of young people. It stopped my heart, but it also kind of like, okay, challenge accepted there to do that. So how do we, for as much as your organization is aiming to help young people be very savvy consumers, I'm sure that with that, you've probably seen a lot of what media organizations could be doing to prepare for young consumers.
We do that. We tend to look at it from the other angle, though.
Yeah.
So we spend a lot of time in classrooms and with teachers to understand habits and to kind of understand where the disconnect is. And I think you pointed this out earlier, too. I mean, kids get it, right? They... Yeah. But they don't always understand that they have a voice. So I've been in countless classrooms where students are looking at news. And like you said, like, this doesn't apply to me, but this does. And what we've been able where we've been able to break through is to teach students that they have a voice. So I was talking to you about action earlier. We're finding that after students are going through our curriculum, they are reporting that they are much more likely to ask for a correction or to write a letter to an editor for whatever, whether it's an opinion or a correction, and also to do things like to vote or to vote when they're 18. So we're finding that if we get in that moment and get them beyond, to kind of to teach them that critical thinking, right, to move beyond Google, you know, to click deeper, to think a little deeper, kids get it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've long said that with so many things. It's the rest of us that mess it up. So what can parents and teachers be doing? I think I want to start with teachers, but we do need to take a break. So I'm curious what parents and teachers can be doing to help the young people in their lives to be more savvy consumers of media. We're talking with Erica Hobbs, who is the Chicago program manager of the News Literacy Project. You can find out about the work that they do at thenewsliteracyproject.org. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big old topic and we spend the whole night wrestling with it. And that topic tonight is media literacy. And there are many, many pieces of it and how we deal and interact with news, how we think about news, how we share news, what we take from news. is a big one. It's a big one. And if you don't believe me, I don't know, look at any major news source in the political section right now and the conversation about fake news. And you will see that that, in fact, is a big, big topic. And it's a very important one. So here with us is Erica Hobbs. She wears many hats at the News Literacy Project. You can find out about them at thenewsliteracyproject.org. And I will make sure a link to that organization is up on the WGN Radio page once the archive of this show is up and posted. But you are the Chicago Program Manager, Communications Director, Director, boss, honcho, person, all the things that you do there. You do lots of things for this wonderful organization. But we were, right before the break, we were talking about kids and media literacy and how the work that your organization does, how you talk about that with them and some of the tactics that you take. But I'm curious how parents and teachers can help when we you know, start to think about how can I make my child or my student a more savvy consumer of news. That seems very daunting. That seems like a big conversation to start. That's probably pretty intimidating. What advice would you have for those adults that have the power to influence young people in that way?
Well, sure. So they can come to us. So we have tools and tips and resources on our site.
Don't reinvent the wheel, people. Go to the people who know.
Right. And so, you know, one of the things that we know, too, and that research has shown is that students pick up news in much more nuanced ways. And I'll tell you that from my time in the classroom, too, students will tell me that they understand or they've heard something that happened and they realized it was on because or that they heard it on the radio or on the TV in the background when they're getting ready for school in the morning. Mm. So that's one way that parents can help, maybe ask, right, and talk to them about it a little bit. And then teachers, too, can come to us. You know, that's where our specialty is. So we operate in a couple of ways. So we do have a very intensive classroom program that sends our staff members into the classroom to work closely with teachers to develop and to deliver our curriculum. It's a very personalized program. But we also have what's called the Checkology Virtual Classroom. And that is what has brought us to scale. That's why we're able to reach about 6,000 teachers and about 700,000 students across the country and internationally. And what that does is it gives teachers an online suite of newsletter literacy lessons. It's very immersive, interactive. Those lessons are led by journalists and by subject matter experts. I mean, they can be done in an order that's right for teachers or for parents too, for homeschoolers. And we also offer resources, like I said, on our site. So we do have what we call virtual visits and webinars. We do have handouts, and then you can always just bug one of us for ideas, right, too. Right.
You're going to regret saying that when you get flooded with listener emails or something. No, I'm sure it'll be all good. You know, I want to back up to something you touched on about how students you notice would say, oh, I heard about that when it was really kind of in the background. And this is something that I mentioned with an earlier guest, but something that absolutely drives me crazy, and that is our new way of saying that we've read something or that we're familiar with a story. I have caught myself saying, and this to the dismay, I'm sure, of people who are connected to me on social media, if I share something on Facebook, I'll say, hey, don't internet read this. I need you to really read it. Or I'll say, read to the end for the nuances. I find myself asking people to look beyond just the headline. I'm asking people to read the whole thing. That's not even students. That's adults. Those are colleagues. Those are, you know, my entire social network. And I think that we are in that habit. And I first started thinking about this when I said, oh, did you hear about this story? You know, it was in the New York Times, this thing that happened. And someone said, yeah, I saw that. Okay. But I asked you if you read it. Did you read it? No, I saw it. And that was such a moment to me where I was like, oh, wait, we're not reading them. We're in fact just kind of skimming or looking. And I think that's valuable to point out, too, that there are many ways to hear them. And I think we saw that probably in the last election, as I know there were a lot of parents that felt strongly one way or the other about a political candidate that were either trying to talk about or shield their, you know, talk about the candidate or shield their child from that candidate. And it didn't really work. I feel like there was a lot of parents that said, how did my kid learn this word or know about this thing, which is really, really interesting. But we think about those traditional outlets. What are the other outlets we need to think about when we think about media literacy for young people?
So you and I are probably used to TV and radio, right, and newspaper. Students are getting their information from Facebook. Not so much Twitter, a little bit. They tend to be kind of, you know, bystanders on Twitter. But it's from Facebook. And it's also from word of mouth. It's that same kind of thing that you were just talking about. It's like, hey, did you hear this? And then students will go and look it up either. You know, they'll Google it or go on Facebook.
Yeah.
Right? So what we have to do is to teach students exactly what you said and read beyond the headlines is one of our mantras, right? So we teach students the steps to take to dig a little deeper, to figure out what the source is or what the intention might be.
There's so much there. There's a lot there. And the more we dig into this topic tonight, the more I'm just like, well, oh my gosh, it's so much bigger. We need 2 more hours to do all of these things and talk about this. So what are things that parents and you know, aunts and uncles and all of those things can do to model good media behavior for young people?
We like to say think before you share, maybe pause
before
you share.
I wish I could say that every single day long. Yeah.
Or, you know, if maybe you agree or disagree, or if you find something that's not quite right about the post, then say it, right? They could do questioning on their own, right? They can call out corrections and clarifications, because it's not just fake news, right, that we're talking about, even though that is, you know, the topic of the day. I mean, there are other things that are important too. So you want to understand whether something is accidentally wrong and whether the record needs to be corrected. And so parents or aunts or uncles or grandparents can kind of stop and pause and think about it and find out what actions should they be taking to, like you said, to model it for their children.
Yeah, there's so much to it. So if someone is listening and they are like, I'm on board, I love this, I want to know more, where can they go and how can they support the work that your organization is doing?
Sure. So we're at the newsliteracyproject.org. And you can support us in many different ways. So financial, obviously, is one, but we're always looking for volunteers and for talent to help us out and to get our message out to classrooms across the country.
And I assume on social media, too, and we can connect with you there and all
we
that good stuff.
We are at the News LP.
I would be worried if you weren't, right? Definitely right. On social media. Well, so again, I will put links to all of that good stuff on the WGN Radio page so you can find it. And I will be sure and tweet out links to all of that good stuff later. Erica Hobbs, thank you so much for being with us this evening and talking about this very complicated topic. I feel like we just got started and we could sit here for another 2 hours and talk about young people and media habits and all of that. But nonetheless, you have raised some very thought-provoking issues. And we will all go and look at the resources at thenewsliteracyproject.org. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
All right. So we're going to take a little break and then we're going to get you to news and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with the executive director at the National Association for Media Literacy about all the many topics we have raised this evening. And again, I think we're just going to keep on needing more time. We may have to just run into the next show a little bit. They won't mind if we take another hour to keep this topic rolling. It's all good. Anyway, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special, and tonight's topic is media literacy, and we have been talking so far on the program about many, many aspects of it, and indeed, I will be the first to tell you it is way too complicated of a topic for us to completely unpack and solve in 2 hours. But as with many topics that we take on this show, it is always better to wrestle with them and consider them and start down the path than to avoid them entirely. It's very important for us to talk about these big issues. And so that is what we do. So joining us now in our discussion around media literacy and all of these big topics is Michelle Lipkin, the executive director of the National Association for Media Literacy Education. Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have been wrestling with some very big topics tonight as we look around all these issues that are connected to media literacy. And it's certainly one that's very much up right now. And it's in the news a lot in many different forms. But I want to start with just kind of the first step into this. And that is, as you see it and the work that you do and with your organization, how do you personally define media literacy?
Well, thank you. Thank you for starting there, because it's always great to start with the definition, because a lot of people don't really know what exactly it means when we're talking about media literacy. And of course, as you said, these times, media literacy and the moment for media literacy now, it feels very present and relevant. So we're in a lot of ways very grateful that people like you are bringing this topic to the community. So the way we define media literacy is the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, create, and act using all forms of media. So in the simplest terms, we look at media literacy as an expanded definition of literacy for the 21st century. You know, no longer is it sufficient to just teach traditional print literacy, although, of course, that's foundational and important and significant. But we need to go beyond that and make sure that we are teaching our students and really all learners how to read and write and consume and author using all forms of media texts available in the 21st century.
Very, very important. We were just talking with the Chicago program manager of the News Literacy Project, which I know has partnered with you guys on a couple of things where young people are concerned about how to get those conversations started with young students. And it is so very important. But the first thing you named, I think, is very, very key, and one I think that isn't raised as much, and that is access.
Right.
Where do we begin on that conversation about access?
It's so interesting that you asked me that question, because you are so right. We hardly ever talk about that. We are right now, and even media literacy educators right now, we're so focused on this analyze and evaluate because of so much of the cultural conversation right now about falsehoods and truth and all of these really important topics. So we're really spending a lot of time in the space of analyze and evaluate, and we don't spend a lot of time with access. And I think that, you know, we have a long way to go in our country regarding access to media tools, to the internet, to broadband, all of these things. Like, we talk so much about schools in terms of what technology they have or what media they have accessible to students. And the truth is there's still many, many, many students in this country and many people in this country that do not have access to the current technology and current media tools that are, you know, in some ways running our country right now. So we really need to look at that, look at all of these things as the whole, right? So we can't just focus on analyzing and evaluating. We can't just focus on creating and acting. We really have to address all of them to be a fully media literate society.
Truly, truly. And it's very interesting how when Twitter first started, I remember I joined Twitter in 2007. And I remember at the time talking with other journalists about, I think this is going to be so essential that we use this. And I remember in those first couple of years, people would still giggle when you would even say the word tweet. But now it's so it's changed so much. That is a primary communication tool from the White House even. And it's fascinating to me how to see that evolution. And now no one smirks at the term tweet, because we see how it's being used. And in fact, that's not separate from other more formal methods of communication from even a government office, which is really fascinating.
Right. And I do think that we, you know, we have a pretty complicated information ecosystem right now. And it's happened very quickly. And sometimes we don't talk enough about that. I think that everyone feels relatively overwhelmed with the amount of information that's flowing towards us every day. Right. But I think we don't recognize that part of that overwhelm is because it's so new and we don't quite know how to process all this information. I mean, you mentioned Twitter, and you know, I love this this stat that, you know, when President Obama took office in 2009, Twitter users were posting about 300,000 tweets per day, and now they post 500 million daily. So the system, like,
so that's
is
a jump.
Exponential. Yeah, that's just a little bit of growth. But there's so much to that fact, right? So much to that statistic, as far as the actual level of and sheer volume of information in those tweets, and the sheer volume of people that are participating in just Twitter, right? That's just Twitter. And so we have, like I said, a very complicated information ecosystem that is added to that very new, that we're all kind of still catching up on what does this mean? Like, what does this mean for society? What does this mean for information flow? What does it mean for the news industry? It's all very new, and it doesn't surprise me that we're struggling a little bit. And I think that we also have to kind of give our society a little bit of a break, in the sense that, you know, we need some time to get used to this level of inquiry and information, and so it doesn't really surprise me how, you know, even the growth of fake news and misinformation, it kind of makes sense when you think of the speed and the increase in the amount that some things were going to go wrong, right? That some things were going to mess up some places, and now we get to kind of figure this out now. Now everything's kind of out in the open, and we have a lot of work to do to understand and figure out how to educate around this new information ecosystem.
Truly. And so what do you think, what is the biggest enemy of media literacy right now? Is it that volume, or is it something else?
Well, I think, truthfully, the biggest challenge for media literacy education in general in the States is that we're still very dependent on kind of individual passionate educators. So, my organization is the national organization, and so we see ourselves kind of as the umbrella organization, and we have thousands and thousands of members around the country that are doing extraordinary work in classrooms from pre-K to higher ed. And they're doing amazing work, and there's amazing resources out there for people interested in bringing media literacy tools into the classroom. The issue and the challenge is that you can't, it is very difficult to spread things nationally when you're really, really dependent on these people in individual schools, right? An individual passionate person to bring it to that school. And so the biggest challenge is really getting states to recognize the importance of figuring out how to put some mandates or standards in place so that teachers are getting trained on media literacy, and that we are really making sure that schools are focused on things like media literacy and digital citizenship. Now, we've seen some really great work being done, and we're part of a coalition with Media Literacy Now and Common Sense Kids Action, where we have, you know, media literacy legislation moving now in 12 states. And so really that's the biggest challenge, is how do we create kind of a national revolution in education to recognize that media literacy is not something that would be wonderful if we could get to. It's absolutely an essential 21st century life skill. And if we are not teaching our students this, we are doing them an incredible disservice. And so that to me is like, that's the biggest challenge, is how do we get state by state to look at this as essential? And the truth is, you know, this last election and the way that news has come under scrutiny over the past few months has really, really opened the eyes of legislators around the country. And we've been having just some wonderful progress being made. And the first step is to create kind of advisory committees on the state level to really review annually, like, what are their policies and procedures on digital citizenship and media literacy, so that then we can start to really build best practices and share state by state, and then make it something, you know, I feel, you know, really passionate that it should be a required part of teacher training programs, you know, that the teachers really, really need the support to use media literacy across the curriculum. Because, you know, media is just going to, you know, becomes that much more impactful, that much more important, and we have to really get serious about preparing students for the world that they're actually going to be living and working in, and we're not doing a good enough job of that in our country.
Yes, absolutely agreed, and I'm glad you mentioned digital citizenship, and that's such an important topic, and one that I push on a lot, really, about our behavior. The way that people are behaving and conducting themselves online is real, and mm-hmm. we definitely need to stop this narrative, I believe, of oh, it's just online, ignore it. No, it's quite real, and there can be real economic and professional implications to things like that are quite real. I'm very glad your organization is on top of that as well. So when we look at these best practices and when we go into state levels and what the, you know, what the ideal is, you know, that, that states have adopted this and this is going to be a bigger part of the conversation with education, what are some of those tactics and what are those things that maybe a teacher or parent listening now could be thinking of or participating in?
Well, I think the most important thing, and I think it's, I think it really is very easy because, you know, again, we're overwhelmed. How do we even broach this topic with our kids? How do we talk to our kids about all the information that's coming at them? Is how do we role model question asking? So really the basis of really effective media literacy education is creating habits of inquiry, right? So it's who made this message? Why was it made? What's missing from the message? How might different people interpret this message? Simply asking ourselves, how do I know this is true before I share is a huge question to ask, right? So what we're trying to create with media literacy education are students that are critical thinkers and really asking questions. So we always talk about informed skepticism. You know, we're not looking for people to believe everything they see. We're not looking for people to not believe everything they see. Like, it's all in the middle, right? And it's all how do we ask questions. So oftentimes, you know, I have a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, and things will come up at the dinner table or in the car in conversation that what I, you know, that I don't necessarily know how to address because it's a big issue that came up at school, but it's really like teaching them to think and ask, right? Is stopping and saying, well, where did you get this information? Do you know where they got that information? How do you know that that was something that came from a, you know, a credible source, and talking about it and not trying to just, I always talk about these buckets. Like, we keep putting things in buckets, like this is true and this is false. And the bottom line is it's so much more in depth than that. And so the way that we encourage our students to ask questions and to pause is so important. And you can do that with everything. You can do that with advertising. You can do that with films. You can do that with a social media post. You can do that watching TV, is just asking the right questions. And like I had mentioned some of the key questions, and I really feel strongly that even with the news, if one question that we're asking ourselves, like, what's missing from this message? Who am I not hearing from? And why am I not hearing from that side? Is so important to note. So then I can go and find some additional information about that particular story and come up with my own conclusions and my own thoughts about that topic.
That is.
I don't know. Did that even answer your question?
Absolutely, it did.
I get so excited talking about. I never know if I answer the initial question.
No, I love it. I love it. And I think you raised a really interesting point about asking ourselves, "Who am I not hearing from?" Because I think that even filters out into conversations about history and dominant paradigms and culture and bigger things.
Yes.
Of who's telling that main story and why is that person telling the story and who are we not hearing from? And it's the
and that also talks a lot about bias, because we're doing kind of another disservice by trying to kind of bunch bias in with reliability. You know, all media are biased, right? It's not just Fox News or CNN that are biased to one. Everything's biased. And we're biased. So we need to understand those biases. I'm going to bring my issues, my interpretation, my life story to everything I see and read. And so are you. And so we're going to, it's the reason that two very, very, you know, the best friends in the world can go to a movie that they're both excited about, and one person can walk out saying, I hated it, and one person thinking it was the best movie I'd ever seen, because we all have different interpretations, right? And we need to understand that. And part of the issue I have right now in the conversation that's happening in our country is that this narrative of polarization is so prominent, and we all know deep inside that it's not black and white, you know, that there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people that have very liberal thoughts, but they have other thoughts too. And there are conservative people that have some liberal ideas, and it's a much more complicated country than we're making it. And I think that it's, you know, we're getting into dangerous territory because we're losing the ability to debate and to talk and to discuss because we're putting information and people into, you know, just splitting them in two, right? And that's just not, that's not a good, that's not sustainable, and it's not going to lead us to good things as far as I'm concerned.
I'm sitting here nodding. Absolutely, absolutely agreed. So, so very true. And I'm sitting here also wishing that we had an entire another hour to talk about this because I feel like we're just scratching the surface with all that there is to this topic. So how can people support your organization? They're listening right now and they say, I definitely want to do something to be involved or to support National Association for Media Literacy Education. How can they do that?
Well, here's the most exciting thing. We have our national conference in Chicago, June 26th, 27th, and 28th this year. So I was so excited to hear from you guys because we really want people from Chicago to come to our conference and scholars and media literacy practitioners and people passionate about media literacy will be coming from all over the world and all over the country, and we'll be at Roosevelt University. You can go to namelyconference.net to find out more information. You can also sign up for free membership. We are a free membership organization, and if you're interested in media literacy, you can go to namely.net and join the community for free. We also have U.S. Media Literacy Week, which is in November, and people all over the country participate regionally in events and things going on in their classrooms. And of course, if you are looking for charities to support. We are a nonprofit and we really do rely on individual donors. So if you can set up a monthly donation of any amount, that helps us a lot in moving media literacy education forward. So there's a million ways to get involved. But what I really want your listeners to do is think a lot about the Chicago conference. Our theme is engaging citizens, building community. And we're going to really be looking at civic engagement and how, you know, we become active citizens in the world that we're living in today. And there's extraordinary speakers coming, and I'm so excited. I love Chicago. I've been pushing for us to do it there for like a few years, and so I'm so excited that we're coming to your wonderful city in just a few months.
Very exciting. I will be there for sure. This is a topic.
Please do. Yes, I was just thinking about that. You should come.
I'm very, very passionate about this topic myself, and hence why we took it on tonight. But I will be there for sure. And I will make sure to put a link to the organization and the conference up on the WGN Radio page once this show is archived for people to listen to. So thank you so much, Michelle Lipkin, Executive Director of the National Association for Media Literacy Education. We will see you here in Chicago in June, the 26th through 28th. Hopefully you'll come back on and visit us when you're in town.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a lovely evening.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, so we are going to take a little break right now. We went a little bit over, so we're going to take a little break, and then we are going to come back, round out the show, have some closing thoughts, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, that does it for us tonight on the Saturday Night Special. And, you know, I say this every time, but it's always the case. We pick these big topics, we wade into the water, and then suddenly I realize we need two more hours. But nonetheless, we have to say goodnight for this week. We will put links to all the stuff that we talked about tonight up on the podcast page at WGNradio.com. Just search my name and you shall find it. But I'll also be tweeting these things out and all that good stuff. Thank you to my guests, Amanda Warner, Ashley Humphrey, Erica Hobbs, and Michelle Lipkin. Wonderful information and a wonderful conversation. And special thank you to esteemed producer Tom Hush. Big things were brought up tonight, and there's no way, as I said, we could do them all justice or completely solve them all. But I think just opening the box and lifting up the lid and looking into these big topics are super important. And tonight we talked a lot about reading beyond the headlines, really reading and taking in information and asking ourselves important questions about who wrote this, why, what voices are missing, and really thinking about the very complicated information ecosystem and aiming at informed skepticism with the things that we're doing, but also bearing in mind issues of access and critical thinking and all the other things that we raised tonight. So I hope that your mind is going, as is mine, after looking through all of these big topics. We will see you next time on the Saturday Night Special. That does it for us. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. It is 9 o'clock on the dot. Here's news with our good friend David Jennings.